Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, a conversation with Matt Dunn of City Folk about that organization's decision to cancel their upcoming season. We'll go bear hunting with Community Voices producer Ron Rollins. Larry Antosh is Senior Director on Environmental Policy for the Ohio Farm Bureau. Today, we'll talk algae blooms. And we've got Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. Up first, this week, a new telephone emergency alert system was used by the village of Yellow Springs during a deadly standoff with police on Tuesday night. WISO's Emily McCord reports on how that system was deployed.
The HyperReach phone system was purchased by Greene County last year. On Tuesday night, this message went out to Yellow Springs residents.
Residents in the 200 and 300 block of North Stafford are advised to vacate their homes.
But at a press conference, Greene County Sheriff Gene Fisher says evacuation was not his recommendation. Fisher says he did want the HyperReach system to let residents know of the emergency situation, but...
We didn't want them to leave their house. We were not at that time convinced that the person was in the house, that he could have been mobile, and we didn't want to put the residents in that neighborhood in harm's way.
The HyperAlert system can be initiated from several places: Greene County, Miami Township Fire Rescue, and the Yellow Springs Police Department. That's where this warning was dispatched. Yellow Springs manager Laura Curlis says local police on the scene determined that evacuation was the safe call.
The officers on the scene make decisions about timing as to when it might be safe for people to evacuate to get out of an area that might be dangerous to them. There are other times when, no, it's not safe and they want people on lockdown. So the officers on the scene made a decision that the 200, 300 block could be vacated at a certain point in time.
Curlis says that phone call did not put any residents in danger. At another press briefing, she said officials will be looking into how the HyperAlert system is used in the future. For WYSO, I'm Emily McCord.
And by Friday, Yellow Springs Council President Judith Hempling and Vice President Lori Asklund released a detailed statement about the recent standoff situation and the death of Paul Schenck. They expressed deep regrets of the loss of a community member and advised citizens that the Ohio Crisis Response Team from the State Attorney General's Office and the Greene County Victim Assistance Program have offered their help. The Ohio Crisis Response Team is a volunteer organization responding to communities in the aftermath of traumatic events. City Folk's Board of Trustees voted Monday to suspend its 2014 season of events, but it's not necessarily the end of the road for the arts organization. This week, I spoke to City Folk President Matt Dunn and asked him to explain what was behind the decision.
After deliberations and assessing our financial situation as an organization, not just based on the festival, but based on everything that we do, we came to the realization and made the decision that we couldn't afford to go forward as an organization. So we have opted to pursue jazz, which has been in our line of programming and for which we have a dedicated source of funding, at the same time dissolving our other programs or suspending our other programs, including the festival, our educational programs, and our normal concert season.
And that's a designated grant that you have to continue the jazz programming, correct?
That is correct. And so we will be assessing our options in the coming weeks of how that might look for us to continue to present jazz with an all-volunteer board or volunteer staff, you know, whether we can handle ticketing or whether we look for an organization to do the presenting, and then we would become their sponsor, would be a possible model, and looking for other ways to partnering with other people to do the jazz on our behalf.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that City Folk will still be there in name and in presence. It's just dropping major events, the calendar of events for the next, the 2014 season and beyond.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and that could give us an opportunity to retool, to resurge, and you know, find new blood and new talent to offer the community what we've been known for in terms of the diversity of our programming. But it also shrinks the organization down to the bare bones, just in order to stay operational.
City Folk, born out of the National Folk Festival in the mid-90s, I think.
Yeah, City Folk itself as an organization, as a nonprofit organization, dates back even further than that. We're celebrating 33 years this year. But yes, the National Folk Festival came to Dayton in 1996, and they had a 3-year run as a national folk festival with the idea of turning that over to a local organization, and City Folk was that organization and has continued the festival ever since.
Do you think that national festival and then the work that City Folk did after that put the organization on the map as far as the Miami Valley is concerned?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's quite an honor to have that festival in a community, and I think that it was also at the right time. You know, I think the City Folk Festival, whether it was in its current iteration or whether it was the National Folk Festival, it predated things like an African American festival or a Celtic festival or a Latino festival and all those types of diverse offerings that we have in the community now. So it certainly had its place for a long time as the preeminent or premier arts and cultural organization that was really about showcasing diversity.
And I was going to ask you to assess City Folk's overall impact. You touched on it just there, but can you go back to City Folk's beginnings?
I think that it's fair to say that City Folk, the community, the diversity of the world, and our place in a larger world, and being able to expose people to different artistic traditions and cultures and appreciating them. And that has been true for all of our existence. So from our founding all the way to most recently the festival, but then also our Culture Builds Community educational program that worked with kids in schools and recreation centers to teach them the value of diversity and how much we really all have in common through the arts. And, you know, we were using the arts as a bridge between cultures, both for adults and for kids.
What reaction from the residents of Dayton are you hearing?
The community is generally sad. I think there was a general love of City Folk, both as an organization and of the festival. But I think we're also, some of the reaction I'm seeing are people who didn't understand that we were an organization with year-round programming, and they maybe think that we're just a festival that blew it, that we ran our course, and they didn't understand that we were a nonprofit organization with a staff and year-round programming, and the festival wasn't an entity unto itself, but it supported a larger vision. And I think there might have been a disconnect in the community regarding that.
And so is that something that will be looked at if you say you're taking a kind of a background role right now and this could be a chance for you to retool, and so that disconnect will be something that you'll look at in the future?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we need to do what's responsive to the community, too. You know, I think the other thing is that while we were about presenting diversity, presenting folk and traditional music are art forms that aren't common. So, you know, a show that we might have on our concert season may not necessarily fill the Schuster Center, but it would not be a scalable show if we were to present it, say, in a jazz club or a nightclub. So one of the challenges that we have had recently is filling the house and finding appropriate size venues for the types of entertainment that we bring, because the market just isn't there for a niche program style.
Right, and weather in the last couple of years, it seems like you haven't received much help there either.
No, last year's festival devastated us. So the 2012 festival left us with significant debt that we worked to pay off through a fundraising campaign, and then also working to extend terms from our vendors. And we're happy to say that we had all that paid off by December of last year. But then going into this year's festival, had two things going against us. One was we chose to charge admission this year, and then the rain, while it did not rain in downtown Dayton, except for a couple instances, maybe 10 or 15 minutes here and there, it did rain in the surrounding area. So I think that if it might have been raining at somebody's home, they might not have realized it wasn't raining across town. So our attendance was certainly almost zero last year, and this year was certainly, it did not meet our expectations.
Just one more question. If you could reiterate, I guess, the positive for this, that you'll still be focusing on the jazz programming, and describe a little bit about what that presence will be.
We're looking at continuing our jazz in one form or another because of the dedicated funding source, but we're looking at our options as to whether that might involve presenting one big show, a blockbuster-type show that would be jazz, or whether we might have a series of two or three shows if we can afford what the endowment provides for, or we could look at doing a combination of a show or two, and maybe an educational residency, because residencies and educational programs are allowable uses of that money. So we're hoping at least that through the endowment we can continue to have an impact regarding an art form that is commonly going by the wayside, and we have a role that we can play in preserving and presenting that.
Well, part of what you just described there kind of sounds like the Culture Builds Community program, some similarities there, but that is also being discontinued, correct?
That is correct. We had a lot of community partners that were part of our Culture Builds Community program, and I think everybody sees the value in what the arts can do to bridge cultures and to create those multicultural experiences, and we're hoping that some of our partners will step up and keep those programs running regardless of who's actually implementing them.
Matt Dunn with City Folk, thanks so much for speaking with us today, and good luck with everything.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Lights are flashing on the highway. I wonder if we're gonna ever get home. I wonder if we're gonna ever get home tonight. Everywhere the water's getting rough. Your best intentions may not be enough. Gonna ever get home tonight. But if you break down, I'll drive out and find you. If you forget my love, I try to remind you. Stay by you.
Music from Patty Griffin on Why So Weekend, When It Don't Come Easy. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is Why So Weekend on WYSO. We get a lot of bad environmental news these days, so for a change, here's some good news about nature. In the last few years, wildlife, including large wildlife, has bloomed in parklands and green spaces in southwestern Ohio. Some of the critters we're talking about may even surprise you. WYSO Community Voices producer Ron Rollins visits Five Rivers Metro Parks to learn more.
I love the outdoors, and I've seen how wildlife have gradually returned to the Miami Valley. Last winter, I saw something that absolutely stunned me, a bald eagle in downtown Dayton. See, I was on Veterans Parkway along the Great Miami River, and there he was, up in a tree, bold as brass, white head gleaming. Now, I still remember reading Rachel Carson's Silent Spring as a teenager and being sad about the disappearing eagles. I had to learn more about this guy. I called Five Rivers Metro Parks, and I got their spokeswoman at the time, Beth Miller, on the phone, and I told her what I'd seen. She just laughed. "Ron, the eagles are old news around here," she said. "We've got a bear. A bear. Right here in Montgomery County, Ohio."
Bears are quite lazy, and so they like to walk on trails just as much as people do. So after a rain like this, when the ground is really soft, is an excellent time to look for bear tracks.
So I'm hiking with Mike Enright, the conservation biologist for Five Rivers. His job is to monitor and protect all the wildlife in the system's 16,000 acres. On a rainy morning last spring, we struck out on the bear's turf. We're going on a bear hunt. We're looking for bear.
It kind of is like Bigfoot sightings, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's why when we get a sighting, we always go out and check, because, you know, it could be somebody's dog, but, you know, we want to make sure that it really is a sighting, and we also want to, you know, kind of gather some information around it to make sure he's not displaying any behaviors he shouldn't be. So a single bear in 6,000 acres has a lot of room to hide, and people don't see him regularly, so obviously he knows what he's doing in avoiding people.
That's going to be his game plan, right?
Yes. Yeah. He hasn't shown any signs of being interested in human garbage or interacting with people, so that's a good sign for him and for us. If you see logs flipped over that are kind of scratched up, that's the bear looking for grubs. And they'll roll over logs that weigh 200-300 pounds. So that's obviously a bear, not kids playing around in the woods. And my favorite is bears leave very big piles of poop around that that don't look like anything else. So
if someone does actually encounter Mr. Bear as they're hiking around, what should they do?
Well, just be calm. Obviously, don't yell and scream at him. And just stop and let him go on his way. If he hasn't seen them, he'll probably just keep doing whatever he's doing and move off onto the woods.
So, okay, you probably won't see Mr. Bear. Doesn't matter how hard you look. But I learned he's really just the furry tip of a very large wildlife iceberg around here. Five Rivers is full of coyotes, beaver, foxes, all kinds of owls, wild turkeys, at least three nesting pairs of bald eagles, and so many deer that they have to be controlled by bow hunting, or else they destroyed the forest for all the other animals. Turns out, there's even some big cats.
We had our first bobcat here in the Twin Valley in 2003, and it's a fun story how we realized it was here. One of my coworkers was working late one evening and heard what she thought was a woman yelling at the top of her lungs out in the park. And so she came in and explained this to me, and I said, you know, it's February, that's not a woman yelling, that's a bobcat mating call. And so we've started doing investigations, and since then the neighbors have reported seeing them, and we've also captured them on remote camera. So
have cougars, mountain lions come back into Ohio?
The jury is still out on that. I occasionally get reports of mountain lions, but they usually turn out to be yellow labs. But we still go out and investigate because both South Dakota and northern Michigan have populations, so it's theoretically possible that they could migrate through.
That's a long trip from South Dakota.
It is, but they're showing up regularly in Illinois, so we're just a stone's throw away from there.
Wow, cougars. So how did this happen? Well, it's a combination of things. Species are protected now. Park systems like Five Rivers have added more green space and habitat over the years. Streams are clean enough now for restocking of fish that had disappeared. And the animals themselves have learned how to share space with us. And Wright says that's okay, that the return of wildlife is really something we should all feel pretty good about.
It is. It's been a great success. You know, the conservation of wildlife, specifically in North America, has been a huge success. You know, the population's kind of tanked in the late 1800s, early 1900s, but because people recognized that without action, wildlife would disappear, a lot of people took steps to preserve it, let it increase, you know, regulate taking of wildlife. And so really now we're reaping the effects of those things that were done earlier this century with the wildlife coming back. And the big thing is it provides a personal connection to nature. When people see a turkey or a deer or a bear, you know, that's something that stays with them. People really enjoy that wildness in metro parks, and that's a big reason why I think the community has been so supportive of us, because they can come see things like that.
The bear could actually have moved on a long time before you realized it, as rarely as you see him, right?
He could, and like I said, eventually we expect him to probably move back, you know, down south, looking for a female bear at some point in time. So we're happy he's here. But we understand it's probably not going to be permanent.
That's kind of too bad. We didn't find the bear.
We didn't find the bear, but it's looking for a very small needle in a very big 6,000-acre haystack. So
I still think we got to come up with a name for him. Bob Boo Boo. I like that. Yogi. Why not? Hey.
For WYSO's Community Voices Project, this is Ron Rollins.
Some folks say there ain't no bears in Arkansas. Some folks never seen a bear at all. Some folks say the bears go around eating babies raw. And some folks got a bear across the hall.
Ron Rollins is editor of the Dayton Daily News and one of WISO's newest Community Voices producers. You can hear all the stories from this year's course in 2 hour-long specials airing at 7 p.m. on Sunday, August 11th and Sunday, August 18th. And meet the new Community Voices producers as well as course instructors Sarah Buckingham and Nina Ellis at a special screenless screening at the Film Dayton Festival on Saturday, August 24th at 11 a.m. at the Neon. Just bear up to my bewildered best. And some folks even see the bear in me. Algae blooms will likely once again cause problems for lakes and streams in Ohio this summer. Larry Antosh is Senior Director on Environmental Policy for the Ohio Farm Bureau. I spoke with him about the basics of algae blooms and what might be going right for us this summer. We started with where the blooms come from.
As the Earth gets a rainfall event, Mother Nature gives the Earth a bath. And so as that rain lands on the land surface, some of it soaks in and some of it washes off. And when it washes off, it carries materials with it. If the rainfall event is a heavy enough amount. If it's in an urban area, we're looking at wash off of driveways and sidewalks and rooftops. In an agricultural area, we're looking at wash off from farm fields. Depending on the time of the year, that rainfall may be hitting a ground that's covered with residue from the previous year's crop, maybe landing on a hay field, might be landing on a corn or a soybean field. And those plants could be at various stages of development. So the timing of the rainfall, the intensity, and the amount all have an impact on what does wash off or can wash off and leave a field.
And, of course, lakes and streams are being affected by some of that runoff.
Yes, a lot of it depends on the timing of the rainfall event and or the timing of the nutrient application. If fertilizers are placed on the surface just prior to a heavy rainfall, and that's again, just applied to the surface and not incorporated or mixed in with the soil, when we get that rain event, materials are dissolved and carried off-site with the storm runoff. If it's a rainfall event that occurred anywhere from 2 to 3 to so many days after the fertilizer is applied, less and less amount of that material will leave the fields because the fertilizer is incorporated in the soil, it attaches to the soil. So unless we're getting runoff events that take sediment with it, we'll have lesser amounts of nutrients leaving the crop fields.
You're saying the best bet is for that fertilizer to get into the soil rather than to be on top when the rainfall hit. And I would imagine that farmers have been aware of that for some time.
Yes. As we think about nutrient management and the whole principles of 4R nutrient stewardship, in which we're looking at the 4R stand for the right place, right amount, right time, and the right form. You know, the fertilizer bill is probably the highest bill that a farmer has. And so utilizing everything that they put down on the fields and not having it wash off is money in the pocket to the farmers.
Right now, you mentioned that we have a crop canopy. So the biggest potential for chemical runoff would be in the earlier planting season, what, April through June or?
Well, the predictive models, or the model that being used to predict the extent of the blue-green algal bloom in western Lake Erie Basin, looks at the March through June time period, and the relationship is based off of the total amount of stream flow in the Maumee River, and then it's a comparison on 12 years of a 12-year average. So looking at where that cumulative loading is compared to where it's been over the past 12 years. The result for this year was that the stream discharge in the Maumee was little above average, and because of that, the prediction for the August algal bloom in Lake Erie is considered, the terminology that they used was significant. Essentially, it's projecting about a 300 square mile algal bloom, which is about a fifth of the size that it was in 2011.
Okay, and that was a fairly significant year with many lakes and streams that are normally tourist attractions being closed down for some activities that take place there.
We have had, 2010 was probably the worst in terms of, in recent times, in terms of inland lakes, where we had about 20 different inland lakes that had some type of an advisory posted on them, either for swimming or other contact with the water. And again, the reason being that the blue-green algae or harmful algal blooms do produce a toxin, and then that is a concern from a human health standpoint. So the advisories go up to warn visitors to the lakes that they should either limit or not have contact with the water because of a potential for a health issue.
You mentioned the warning for this August season is significant. What are some of the things that might prevent these algae blooms from growing to expectations?
Okay, blue-green algae are a common, they're part of the aquatic ecosystem. All lakes will have blue-green algae in them. They can outcompete the green algae, or what would be considered the good algae, when conditions get right for them to grow and bloom or have a rapid increase in growth. When the water temperatures get warm, blue-green algae like warm water. When there's plenty of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus present, so there's a lot of good food for the plants to utilize. And especially if we get into these dog days of summer where it's that hot, dry, not real windy, just kind of stagnant air, calm water, warm water, plenty of nutrients, perfect conditions to grow blue-green algae. Those are the conditions that they like to grow in. That's when they flourish, and that's when we'll see them. This current year, at least especially this past week or so, we've had very cool weather. Lake temperatures are probably not warming up as much as they have in the past years. We also have been getting a lot of rainfall, and so plenty of water coming in and flushing and flowing through the lakes, and so we're not getting that stagnant water, warm water, calm water. If the conditions continue, there's a good chance that we probably won't see the blue-green algal blooms to the extent that we have seen in past years.
Larry Antosh is Senior Director on Environmental Policy for the Ohio Farm Bureau.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the sixth week of middle summer. The trajectory of August and the transition to late summer are made up of interlocking associations. Some of these connections are used by farmers and gardeners, and others are tools for awareness of how the world fits together. Throughout the month ahead, when spiders start to increase their building of webs in the woodlot, then the yellow jacket season begins in the windfalled apples and the plums, and then morning fogs increase in the valleys. When the lilies are gone, summer stabilizes in the golden purple coneflowers. The tall wing stem and ironweed and the rich opening of ragweed, the green budding stalks of the goldenrod poised, their full season still ahead. When black walnut trees have lost about a third of their leaves, then hummingbirds and wood ducks and Baltimore orioles and purple martins start to disappear south. When cardinals stop singing before dawn, then the soybean leaves are yellowing in the fields and farmers start to cut corn for silage. When long flocks of blackbirds move across the sky, then it's time for plums to be the sweetest of the year. When all the summer apples have been picked, then the first puffball mushroom of the year swells in the cool, damp night. When there's more than one Judas maple tree in the woodlot, then hickory nutting season is underway. And when the last of the garden flocks die back, then ragweed time winds down, and the year's final tier of wildflowers is budding. The beggar ticks and the burr marigolds, the asters and the zigzag goldenrod. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of late summer. In the meantime, watch and see how, when one thing is happening, something else is happening too. There's always a connection. There's always a fitting together.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to WYSO Weekend. Coming up next, the Book Nook.